when we come to topics like the media, it's one topic that all of us have related to in one way or the other. I mean, it's a topic that through TV, through radio, through magazines, through newspapers, we all somehow feel connected to it. And in the ways that it influences us and how it should or not influence us in the ways it probably does is basically the topic for this evening. So we all can somewhat call ourselves all experts, but we have three people who at least have given it a little pre-thought, and they have taught on this topic off and on, I think, through the years. Jody Kretzman, Margot Gordon, and Andy Gordon. And they will set the stage for us by having some opening comments, and then I'll moderate the discussion after that. And Jody, you are going first.
All right, well, we'll see what happens here. I've been fascinated by the media for a long time. Let me take off my program coordinator hat for a moment and put on my hat as a former reporter. I was a reporter for a period of time for Time Magazine, for Life Magazine. Never reported for a major city daily, though I know lots of people who have been, and I've been in contact with them. I've been also editor of my undergraduate daily when I was in college. And have written for a lot of media since then, and am, as lots of former reporters are, a media junkie. And therefore think a lot about the relationship between what it is we get fed by the increasingly omnipresent mass media, and what relationship that has, what we get fed, with what's really going on in the real world. So my focus is on always trying to figure out how the media select, because they certainly do select, out of real-world activity, which is, after all, too complicated and too various to be reported as a whole. None of us could take it in. How do they select? Let me just make a couple of comments about that as a former reporter. It seems to me that to be a sort of informed consumer or an informed critic of the media, we have to recognize how it is that reporters generally work. And they work under a set of rules that tells them what news is. News is not every event that happens in the real world. News is what a particular organization that is organized to gather news says news is. How do they know what news is? Let me suggest a couple of ways in which they define news. What parts of the real world get defined as news? Okay, one thing that news has to be, it's fairly obvious, is that it has to be new. If you think about all the things in the world that are not new, for instance, all of us, most of the time, or most of the things that go on in our lives or in our communities, think of the things that are old, that are ongoing in our lives. Most of the world, in fact, is not new. Only that which is new, right, gets reported as news. One of the things it seems to me that might do is to tend to present us with a kind of piecemeal, discontinuous view of what the world outside of our own lives is about. Another thing that news people are addicted to in their definition of news is that news basically has to be an event. If you think about the way one's life goes, the way one's community goes, the way one understands one's world, there are lots of other things out there besides events. Right? There, you could think about the world in different terms. You can think about problems, right? Or you can think about solutions to problems. Or you can think about issues. Or you can think about relationships. There are lots of ways to look at the world besides looking at the world as a set of events. New events. You see how narrow what we get begins to be when you start defining the world this way? I'd say a lot more about that. The third thing I think we need to be aware of is that news basically not only has to be new and tends to be event-centered, but it is also wedded to a series of formulas. That is, news people, like the rest of us, live a lot of their lives by kind of reflex. By a set of accepted definitions. They don't want to make up the world. have to think about new categories every time you go out and cover a story. So they cover stories that fit into certain formulas about the world. And they don't cover stories that don't fit into certain formulas about the world. It seems to me, along with a lot of other observers of the media and, in fact, our general culture these days, that a major formula, for instance, which defines what is news, is the formula that defines world events in East-West terms. If events are easily fit into a formula which defines the world as a conflict between the USSR and the US, then they will be reported. If they are not easily fit into that formula, they probably won't be reported, or if they are reported, they'll be reported through distorted lenses and sort of jumbled up to fit into that formula. You can think of other formulas. They're not all these huge geopolitical kinds of formulas like US-USSR stuff. There are formulas about heroism, for instance, right? I mean, when you get a single individual heroic act, that's a kind of mythic human thing that the news media will cover, whether anywhere in the world, that will be a wonderful news story. It will sort of be accepted as a part of a formula that immediately resonates with all of us. There are lots of others, I think, that we could make a whole list of the formulas that define news for us, okay? So this is just a beginning list of how news gets defined. It might be new, it might be mainly events, it has to fit into formulas. Let me say a couple of things about how else news gets defined in ways that narrow our contact with the real world. Reporters generally are organized within their news organizations into a beat system. You all know a beat system? That is, each reporter has a particular, usually set of institutions to cover. You get the police beat, or you get the City Hall beat, or you get the White House beat, or you get the Pentagon beat. And there are some real advantages to that. One of the advantages to it is that clearly it's possible that a reporter who covers a certain place, City Hall or the Pentagon, after a while might actually know something about the military or about city government. Reporters, after all, are sort of trained not to know anything, right? They're trained to cover what other people do. So which is sometimes a handicap. But you might get some reporters who actually know something if they stay on a beat long enough. It's also true that if you're on a beat, if you're covering a city hall in Seattle or someplace, you're less likely to miss something that happens there. If it happens in City Hall, you're less likely to miss it if you're there every day. But you could probably think of some disadvantages in terms of us as consumers of news, consumers of media, that the beat system sort of has built into it. Not anything about whether a reporter is good or bad, just the system. The major thing, it seems to me, is that anybody who covers a beat knows one thing for sure, and that is that he or she is going to see those same people tomorrow. And that those same people are going to have to be the sources of his or her news story tomorrow. Now think about that. I'm talking to my friend, the police chief here, and she tells me her view of what went on in a raid in a gambling house. Right? I don't get any other views of this. I'm going to pretty much buy your story about that because I know that tomorrow I have to come back to you again and get another story from you. If I went out and tried to dig a little bit about maybe some police corruption that was involved in that gambling raid, right, or a tip-off that might have happened, or if I have something negative to report about your shop, there's certainly an incentive for me not to offend you, right? And I think that's true at the White House. I think that's true at the White House. I think that's true at the Pentagon. I think that's true in all kinds of major institutions. And also, it seems to me, the beat system tends basically to restrict the view of the reporter, the view of the world that a reporter has, to the view of the world held by that institution. If you hang around a police station long enough, you begin to talk like a cop, and think like a cop, and think about areas of your city or your town like cops do. If you hang around churches long enough, you begin to talk like pastors, right? I mean, that just happens naturally to people.
That's what happened to me.
Right. So what you get with the beat system is a kind of house reporting after a while, kind of reflection of the institution, rather than a critical difference. I mean, you could think about another model, right? You could think, well, maybe what I'd like with the Pentagon reporter is some critical distance on Pentagon spending. We don't get it. Why? For the two reasons I think that I've just talked about. They have to deal with those generals tomorrow, and they begin to think like the generals. Okay, what I'm doing here is sort of listing a whole series of things that is nobody's fault, but knowing these things ought to make us at least more critical consumers of news media. And that seems to me to be the first step toward reclaiming the possibility that we can actually act on events and affect them, which is actually my ultimate concern. But let me just stop there right now and see what else we want to do.
Margo?
I teach journalism to people like Jody used to be. at the Medill School of Journalism, which has a very good reputation for training journalists. And this past year, for example, there were, among the Pulitzer Prize winners, there were five from Medill, one of whom had graduated just 2 years before. And so they take a lot of pride in, the school takes a lot of pride in its success in training journalism students. For many years, I've been sort of a thorn in everybody's side, saying that we have to do more than train people to go out and cover beats. We have to make them understand more about what's going on in the world and the changes in the world and so forth. And so I'm sort of a nag within the school. But originally, when we were going to do this, I thought it would be fun to try to have a debate. And I would take the side of the hard-boiled journalist who is very defensive about any criticisms of the media, but I decided I couldn't carry through on it because I'm so against so much of what goes on myself, and have decided that it's a good place to be within a good journalism school to try to do something about it, because they won't accept anything from the outside. If there's criticism, they say, well, you know, we're just reporting the news. We're just reporting what's going out there. We don't make things up. Don't criticize us, you know, for all that bad news. Look at, there's all that stuff out there. Or it's what the public wants. We just give them what they want. And besides, don't worry about it, because we don't have any power. Look at these editorials. We tell people who to vote for, and nobody follows editorial opinion. Most people don't even read editorials. So, you know, what are you worried about? And besides, we have so many time and space pressures, nobody ever pays any consideration to that. Just think of, you know, we have to do all these things in such a short time. I mean, how can they expect us to know everything, be experts on all these opinions? And, you know, with all these newspaper, particularly newspaper mergers, there's all these bottom line questions, and nobody has any money anymore. We can't afford to do this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, really, there's nothing. You just can't criticize us that much. We do a pretty good job under the situation. But for a lot of these reasons and others, there really are a lot of biases in the news that we get. And when the idea of objectivity or creating reality versus reflecting reality, one of the issues is that journalists very often are not reflecting reality, because there's a lot of biases for a lot of reasons, but they are ones that readers should understand. For example, what Jody was talking about, the beat structure, another person has called the news net. And if you think of it as a big fish net, all these beats that cut across organizations, institutions, and sometimes issues, the idea is that they're going to catch all the big fish. These nets will. And not only the beats, but most newspapers and television stations and so forth subscribe to wire services like AP and UPI, and they also subscribe to special services of special newspapers, like the Washington Post has its own wire service, the New York Times has its own wire services, and so forth. And other newspapers can subscribe to those, and all those things together constitute a news net. And if a newspaper or television station has any extra resources left after all that's over, they can sort of spend it on what they want. They can have investigative journalism projects, exposés. They can decide to go on a crusade about one thing or another. And so that's a place to look at what their real agenda is. For example, in Chicago recently, we had a 35-part series over a six-month period, or about a four-month period, on the underclass in Chicago. And it was mostly in Chicago. But it was something that the editor of the Chicago Tribune told me that he'd spent more money on than any other project they'd done. And in the end, I mean, one of the real motivations was to try to get one of these Pulitzer Prizes in public service. Now, they didn't get it, but it was not coincidental that the week before the Pulitzers were to be decided, the whole series came out in a paperback book form dedicated to the people of North Lawndale, which the series mostly highlighted. So that's one type of thing where you can begin to look at the biases of the people running the newspapers, and you can begin to get a feeling for what they are by what special projects they do. The second type of bias is, for all the reasons we were talking about, the money and the efficiency and the time and so forth, there is a bias toward easy news, or what I call easy news. And that is, the really good example is crime news. Most police stations are set up to deal with reporters. There's one person usually who deals with the reporters. And in big cities, they have press rooms, they have phones, they have typewriters, or computer consoles. Everything's all right there. And in New York, they even have a police wire where policemen summarize the most important crimes for the news media, and then the media people then read those and try to pick up on whatever seems most important to them. So after a while, the police themselves learn what it is the reporters want. And there's a bias toward all that. And I'd like to push this point a little more for a minute, because I think it has two really important consequences. One of them is that because there's so much going on in the world in a given day, news people really do have to have some way to kind of organize it. So what they do is they look for sort of themes in the news and ways to sort of kind of help them organize. They'll read the competition, they'll read the other morning newspapers, they'll listen to the TV news, they'll read news magazines, because they have to make sure they're not missing something that competition has. But if they begin to see that there are two or three articles about the same type of issue, for example, crime against the elderly, they'll pick all those stories and they'll put them together on the same page, and you'll see a cluster of stories sort of together. And supposing there's two or three crimes the next day against the elderly, well, they'll pick those up too and they'll run them again, because that'll be one of the themes that's going on in their minds. Now, if the competition picks up that theme in another newspaper, says, gee, they've been running, you know, crimes against the elderly, there must be something going on we don't know about. Why haven't you got that, Jody? You know,
pretty soon you've got a crime wave, right?
And pretty soon you've got a crime wave. And that very thing happened in New York City, where the one newspaper picked it up, other newspapers picked it up, and went back and forth like this, and there appeared to be a crime wave against the elderly at a time when crimes against the elderly had actually gone down. So there was a misperception. Anyone who was reading those papers and paying any attention to it would have thought that there was a crime wave against the elderly, and certainly elderly people would have gotten frightened. And they would have been misled. Now, another way that this is important is in any large city, there is sort of an infinite amount of crime to choose from. The reporters can go and find overnight 50 or 60 or 100 different crimes, some of them more serious than others, to choose from. So what happens is that over time, because it has to be something new, the crimes they report begin to be more and more bizarre and have more unusual twists, and less representative. So a single murder in Chicago is not news anymore. A single rape is not news anymore. It has to be a triple rape, or it has to have some bizarre twist. And so what happens is that what gets reported is more and more unusual, less and less representative, and readers begin to think that crime is even more serious and more bizarre than it really is. So it has a, and it affects their fears about how much they can, how safe they think they are out at night and so forth and so on. So it's kind of unusual aspect of it that has come out in studies that we've done. And the third thing is that there's a bias towards subsidized news. Jody talked about institutions where reporters develop sources. Well, those same institutions, the richer the institutions are, the more likely they are to have big, strong public relations departments that prepare press releases, press kits for the journalists. They hold press conferences. They make it easy for the journalists. It's that they save them time. They give them the factual material. They give them resources that they can call on. Well, the more subsidy that they get, the more likely those institutions are to be covered, and the more likely that they are to be in the news. As we mentioned earlier, there is a bias toward events, and in television, there's a strong bias toward staged events because they have to have visuals, and that's a very important thing. That's their constant thing. Well, what's the visual? That's not a good story. There's no visual, and they always have to have it. How many of you have been to a parade or a football game or anything else where all of a sudden, when the TV cameras turn on, everybody starts clapping or making noise or whatever, and the minute the camera turns away, that everything dies down again? I mean, that the clapping and the noise makes for a better visual. That one other thing that I wanted to bring out is this whole question of balance. We talk about objectivity, and Andy's going to say a little more about objectivity, but we talk about one thing that a journalist is expected to do is to get both sides of a story. You don't print just one side of a story. And so that is, you strive for balance. Well, sometimes that balance in itself can be a bias. Because it may be that 99% of the people, or 99% of the voters, or 99% of people on an issue are on one side. And if you have to have balance to it, it gives a misleading picture about what the real sentiment is within population. And particularly on political issues or other kinds, I'll think of examples. It isn't always representative, or it isn't always reality, to paint a balanced picture. The situation just isn't really balanced in some of those situations. The one other thing that is implied that I'd like to mention, the one other thing is that there are a lot of uncovered stories, important uncovered stories, that are not, that you can't get attention from the media because they are not event focused. They may be process focused. They may not be the kind of news peg that needs to be there for it to get all the way through the process of actually being selected by editors and put into the available space or time. I think I'll stop there and turn it over to you.
Take it away, Andy.
Okay. Let me give some, this is not my profession, but we have a lot of experience with the media. Let me just give you some scatterings of images that come to mind as I hear this from our own experience. Let me say first that, do you remember what George Aiken's solution to the Vietnamese War was? He said, let's just declare that we won and leave. And then everything will be fine. Well, do you remember the Atlanta murders? All these black youths that were getting killed? Do you know that there are just as many black youths getting killed now as there were then? And if you watch a sort of timeline of deaths, it's hardly chased, but the police declared that they caught the murderer. And it was over. Now, before they declared that the murderer was caught, every time a black youth got killed, it was headline news, not only in Atlanta, but nationally. Once the guy was caught, these are just random events. The peg is gone. So that certainly was a national story that kept friends of ours from flying through Atlanta, for example. It was having tremendous consequences on the economy, on the sense of people's fear of the town. All that disappeared, not because any of the events changed, but because it no longer has the news peg it used to. A lot of people go to a lot of trouble to fit themselves into a news peg. Jody and I recently were with the mayor of Chicago at a press conference, and we tried to declare something, may get to it in some of the other things we're talking about, as a really kind of innovative project on affirmative information. Well, the reporters can't make sense of that. It doesn't fit any category they have. Innovation is very difficult for them to get their hands on. But one of the things we talked about was housing. And so in all the stories about this, it was a housing project, because that's what they had a peg on. Housing is an urban issue. Affirmative information isn't an issue they can make sense of. Some people at our center did a study on how police deal with the community, and one way in which that can be phrased, but it was a minor event in the whole thing, was police brutality. We had a fellow who was coached for 2 days on how to have a meeting with the press to release the information we had, and he seemed well prepared. The reporters are sitting there with their poison pens waiting for the quotable quote. And one time, as far as I'm concerned, being provoked by the reporters, he said the term trigger happy. That was in everybody's headline. They like that. Because it becomes an instance that they can deal with. How you deal with reporters, they really do set the agenda, but there's a real irony in what Jody was saying. On the one hand, things have to be news. They have to be new. But on the other hand, they have to fit within beats that are already established. There's a real tension there. So it has to be new to an extent. It has to be evocative, but only within categories that they already understand. It's a real issue. A couple other things. One of them is that we were in London last year. And we had an experience that I wasn't expecting, which is a wholly different form of reporting. Here, all the papers pretend to be balanced, on the one hand, on the other hand. And the only way you find out what they're up to is in the editorials, where you get a sense, and they can always tell us, these are the Republican papers and how many of them went for the administration, these are the Democratic papers. Well, it's much more straightforward in England. Everybody knows what this paper stands for. The Manchester Guardian is on the left, the London Times is on the right, and it penetrates everything they write. Well, I don't think it's any less accurate. You read both newspapers, and you don't get somebody that's waffling on every issue. But you put them together, and you get a sense of what a real position on the news might be. And there's some more things I wanted to say about that. There's just one more, a couple more things. Investigative reporting. We have this wonderful New Yorker, or I guess New York magazine headline, where the Superman has his costume on and he walks into a telephone booth and he says, "Now I got to come out and do some really important work." And he walks out as a mild-mannered reporter. Because everybody wants to be an investigative reporter these days, right? Well, what's the trouble with investigative reporters? They have to have something to investigate. They're always looking for something spectacular that they can undercover that nobody has ever seen before. I have instances, for example, of programs that are taking on very tough cases of kids that are having trouble in their homes and doing a dynamite job with 99 of 100. But because they take really tough kids, one of them screws up every once in a while. That's the headline. So the program has to tailor its activities to make sure that no kid gets in trouble. You know what effect it has? They don't take tough kids. You deal with a problem because you can't afford to be in the headlines. The amount of effort these people go into to avoid becoming an instance that Mike Royko in our town can write about, or somebody else, is really incredible. And what I worry about is the effect it has on all the other cases. Who they're able to take, how much effort has to be go into case management, the covering things up and so on. So I think that's an issue. So it becomes a really conservative effect, because you can't take a chance for fear that somebody out there who won't put the thing in context, their job is not to put things in context, their job is to investigate, to find that instance to hang you on. And finally, this is a slightly different angle, but do you remember Janet Cook? Remember the woman who was the Pulitzer Prize for writing about some young drug addict in Washington, D.C.? She wrote a whole series, and it's a tearjerker, and then it turns out she made it up. There was no such child. Well, everybody was furious, because there's something about the canons of the profession that were so violated that it had people foaming at the mouth. It wasn't an issue that you couldn't side with her. If you talk to people for whom the city is their real beat, they'd say they know kids like that. But she made that kid up by putting together a composite of a lot of real stories. Well, composite stories aren't the way that journalists write. You have to find a real person who's like that and write about them. No real person existed, so she put together a lot of images that were, in a sense, accurate. Now, the kind of accuracy that represented was not tolerated by the industry. But the kind of accuracy that finds one instance, however unusual, and tells it accurately, even though you leave out all those instances, is tolerated. So that's not about getting things right. That's about getting things somehow within the canons of the profession, which may not themselves accurately map the world.
Okay, a lot of food for thought at least going on in my head. Any in yours? Any questions or comments you would like to make?
To me, I think it just points out that we've got humans writing the newspapers, and it's not surprising. I think one of the best courses I ever took in college is a course called Propaganda Analysis, in which we, that time, we used the New Republican Time at that time. And I thought it was extremely good, and I think it stood me in good stead the whole time, showing that well-meaning, conscientious people, depending on what your political philosophy is, you know, and maybe you say bourgeois or exploit people, you know, you use certain words that have certain things depending on how you want to think people. And I thought that in a democratic society that was maybe one of the best parts of that ever could.
I think the problem is that too few American citizens as consumers of media think of their own media as propaganda instruments. I think it's very healthy to think about those media as propaganda instruments, but it's not the way the media think of themselves, and it's not the way most media consumers, I think about their own interaction with media.
Is it even possible to understand reality, even if we would take the progressive time, let's say 5 or 6 different magazines, journals, covering different slants and things, knowing that we understand where the biases are, if we could even read all of that, would we have a closer look at reality, or is there still, because of all these other biases and all these other, I mean, all media is doing all these things to affect their own bias, so we would still get a distorted picture of reality, right?
But the thing that I object to is that it's much easier for me to read things that I know are biased as long as I know what the bias is. It's when they're parading as objectivity and as fact that you get it really, you feel really annoyed. I mean, it's really, I mean, a propaganda course, you might learn how to read the straight news columns on the front pages, not the editorial pages, and figure out that that's really propagandistic. But in most of the time, you don't think of that. And you aren't aware of all these other more subtle things that are keeping you from knowing what the biases would be. to me, reading Time and Newsweek, they're all the same. But if you read, you'd have to read very disparate things, which give you multiple realities. I mean, it's the truth as each of these different organs sees it.
What about the newswire services, which are getting less and less, really comes home to me the tremendous effect the writer of that is. I can remember one listening to a station in Omaha, Nebraska, and then turning on to one in Denver, Colorado. And both of them, the evening news was exactly the same because they were reading off the same newswire, which comes home how one person's view comes across to millions of people.
It's very important. And the worse the financial situation gets, the more important that becomes, because the worse a newspaper, the worse situation it's in, the more it depends on those services, because those are much less expensive than hiring reporters to go out and cover news.
I did a session last week with a few people here on media, and we looked at the Wenatchee paper and the Seattle Times, the papers that I'm not very familiar with, and I was going to do an exercise on local reporting. There was one local reported story on the front page of the Seattle Times, and there was one on the second page of the Wenatchee paper. You had to get the second page of the Wenatchee paper to get a locally reported story. Everything else is wireless.
Are we headed towards that,
do
you think? More and more wire stories and less actual?
Well, there happened to be up on the bulletin board in the dining hall a story now about the press on these chains to buy up more and more newspapers. And I think there's a phrase in there called the Gannettization of America, because the Gannett company has bought up so much, so many. They own 180 or 190 newspapers now, and they're paying millions and $300 million for
the Kansas City papers.
Yeah.
They just bought both the Kansas City papers last 2 weeks ago.
The Louisville.
Louisville?
Yeah. But all the Gannett papers will then get the Gannett wire service. So then they will be fed all kinds of information from Gannett headquarters that they can then use or not use as the local editor sees fit. But you might have the same news coming out in all the different Gannett newspapers in any given day. But then doing that is part of their news net. It then allows them to use whatever resources they have left to do whatever that editor wants to be pushing, whether it happens to be the underclass or if it happens to be an expose on the local mayor or some other type of thing where that's going to take a lot of person power.
One of the problems that I've been reading about the coverage of Nicaragua is that we only use English-speaking news services primarily. And there are news services in Latin America and the Western European countries that have a whole different slant to looking at what's going on there, but we don't see it because it doesn't come across our wires. And a call to responsibility would be at least for balanced news is to get that stuff into our print in some way, which we are not getting unless you really know how to dig. There's a question over here.
How much emphasis, how much percentage is based on selling the paper? So, if I think they're sensationalized or, the most horrible things, as you mentioned, are put in there, how much attention, percentage-wise, 80%, 90% is based on that kind of sensationalism or selling the paper?
And to piggyback on that, the ads, not only the selling, but how much do the ads influence, who buys ad space, influence the news coverage as well?
Well, a newspaper is considered financially sound if 65 to 70% of its space is in advertising. And if it begins to get much below 60%, then everybody's worried. And how much they can charge for an ad, for each line, they call it, in an ad, depends on what the circulation is. So they do anything, almost, to get the circulation up so they can charge more for the ads.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, the same sort of thing goes on with ratings on television. Mm-hmm. The better ratings you have, the more you can charge for your commercials. So they're constantly trying to do things that raise the, that increase circulation or increase ratings. Mm-hmm. So if you have, even though there's no evidence ever proffered for this, or I shouldn't say there's no evidence, there's no, it hasn't been carefully studied or carefully analyzed. Everybody in the news business believes that crime sells.
Yeah.
So, there's sort of an unwritten formula. Like Jody was talking about, one of my jobs was to work on the desk, I was a copy editor, where I'd write headlines and then place things on pages and then see them through the process. Now, one sort of unwritten rule was that you had to have one crime story on the front page every day, and there should be about five stories mm-hmm. on the front page. And, you know, when you look at, if you've done content analysis of the front page newspapers in Chicago, San Francisco, and Philadelphia, and lo and behold, it comes out 90% crime, violent crime on the front page. The more violent and bloody that it is, the more it's thought to sell. And that all comes from the way it all developed historically in the United States, which was copying British newspapers at the time. I mean, it used to be that newspapers were the mouthpieces, they were organs of political parties. And when this country was first founded, they were 6 cents a piece, and only the elite educated read newspapers, and it was all politics, and very boringly written, and hard to read and everything. And then in the 1850s, a man began copying the London formula for this, and he had one reporter whom he sent to the court, and his job was to find the most lascivious story that he could coming out of the courts that day and write it all down and put it in the newspapers, and then they started charging a penny for the newspapers, and that simple switch turned the sort of masses, as opposed to just the elite, turned the masses into newspaper readers. And as a result of that history, it's never questioned now that crime is part of the formula.
Yeah, it's like there's not a real opening for good news, like really good news. How much in a newspaper is really spent on what one would consider positive or, you know, that points to something valuable in the world? Very little of it, or television.
This comes back to Jody's point that heroic things get in, but they have to be spectacular.
That percentage of
it made me think when I was in Texas about 3 years ago, I thought that they had a high percentage of crime on the front page of the paper and then also on television. Being from Minnesota, I don't know if there was a major difference, but it struck me and it struck my sister mom when they first came down there. But, you know, the first 5-10 minutes of the news program was, you know, murder, and it was the front page of the newspaper, and it seemed an overabundance to me compared to,
The local news.
Is that regional or is that just your,
Well, did you happen to notice whether that crime that they were reporting was all local or if a lot of it was from other places?
It was in the local area like Texas.
Yeah, because, that's another part of the formula. Local is much more newsworthy than further away. But in some places, in small town papers and in suburban newspapers, if they print crime, there's much less crime in those kinds of papers, and if they print it, it tends to be far away because they want to give the impression that their community is safe. And these bad things only happen.
Well, another simple point to make about this is that what you were seeing had everything to do with comparing news media and probably nothing at all to do with comparing crime rates in mm-hmm. your new place in Texas with Minneapolis, right?
There was probably some competitive situation there where one newspaper was trying to beat out the other or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know about sweeps? Are people aware of that? Sweeps on television?
Yeah.
On television? Mm-hmm. when they figure out how much they're allowed to charge, it isn't some estimate derived over the year. They have set aside times when their listenership will be metered.
May, and so all February, of a sudden,
you'll have all the best movies against one another, uh-huh. and all the most spectacular series of stories well advertised in advance on the news, and so on and so forth. They're calibrated to the sweeps week because that's what determines their and a few points can make mega dollars of difference. So they really want to drive the listenership up. Now they're really worried now. The most worrisome thing in television now is time shifting. It used to be that Nielsen ratings could tell them whether you were watching or not. Now all it tells them is whether your television is on. And it certainly doesn't tell them whether you're watching the commercials. Because, you're right. It used to be that you could, supposedly in New York, you could be watching the water meters and tell when the commercials were. Because everybody would leave for the bathroom. Well, that isn't true anymore. Because nobody watches the program at the same time anyway. We have a lot of time shifting going on. VHSs have penetrated deeply enough. And not only, it's not in every home, but in exactly the homes they're concerned about. The upscale homes where people are buying things that are being sold in advertising, that people have these machines where they're just skipping by the commercials. It's got the vendors really worried. And they're trying to, and if you'll notice, I think you'll be sensitive, commercials are getting better at a faster pace than programs.
Right.
They're so concerned about keeping your attention that more and more money is being poured into compelling advertising because they figure that's the only way they're going to get you.
Monday morning America. Hmm? Monday morning.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Are there, if you take the formulas, is there any news publications or services that are trying to work out different formulas or knowing that they have to switch the beats, the people around, knowing that they'll lose the contact, but you know, it may be a little more objective? Or how about public radio, public TV news coverage versus, you know, the others? Is All Things Considered and McNeiler Report really more objective, or is it just different biases?
I think that it makes some difference that there are a lot of alternative ways to get information, right? And it makes some difference that there are outlets and programs that spend more time on stories. You get over the event-centeredness, and you have some idea that there's a history to what's ever being talked about. Another way to answer that, Darius, it seems to me, is that, I mean, some of us have the experience, have you ever had the experience of being so closely involved with a series of events, being active in a political campaign, or being active in planning some kind of event, where you knew much more about it than any reporter who was going to cover it, and you knew the next day when the papers came out or when you saw it on television, Andy and I were talking about a press conference with the mayor, you knew how it was distorted, and you knew how badly the papers did on that story. On virtually every story in the newspaper, there are citizens who are in that position, right? Who know more about that story and know what the errors are, right? It seems to me that one of the things we do as citizens, as say Christian people, active in seeking justice in our society, is we pick some areas, we necessarily have to pick and choose, where we will be active enough to consciously deepen our media consumption as well as shape our media, right? We can't do that with everything in the mass media, but we can certainly do that in the areas that we've sort of prioritized for ourselves to be active in. And that's a process, it seems to me, that would be very valuable for everybody to engage in. Make the media in the areas that you're really concerned about.
Don't you think that's a stereotype, though, that everything for my influence is media and politics, the people really do question, and it's scary because they are so powerful. They shape our views on about everything.
You can't fight them.
Mm-hmm. It's true, but I think it's scary because I don't see people questioning a whole lot. I really don't. Is that not true, or is I'm shocked sometimes at how little.
Well, it's I don't. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you listen to the news? I mean, I wonder how many people take it seriously, as if it is an objective version of what happens. I know I don't. I don't talk to many people who do. And I just don't know how, what to make of that. I know, for example, do you listen to this Nightline? Every once in a while, they have a program where they have the audience talk back. I don't know what they call it, but it's an hour or more. They usually extend it, where people question, talk to the reporters, and the reporters are held to account, very particularly for stories. I'm always impressed at the articulateness and the detailed criticism that these people bring. And these are not selected. They go to Abilene, Texas. In fact, I think one of them, or various, they go to Nashville. They go to various auditoriums. They gather the troops, and then people get up at the microphones. I get the impression that we're more conscientious listeners than we're given credit for.
Robert J. Lifton, who's a psychological historian, says that the number one neurosis, I think that's right, in the world today is psychological numbing. That we have a hard time to associate what is truth and what is not, what is reality. And so if you would put some sort of meter on you and you see somebody die on Hill Street Blues and you see it on the evening news, you're not more or less involved with that story. That to survive, we've encountered a certain amount of numbness to what is out there. And so part of it is our own perception of what reality is and the lack of it to even.
Well, and it's true that the general public mixes up crime stories, the ones that they read or hear on television news and the ones they read about or see on television that are drama.
That are drama.
They get it mixed up, and when you ask them to try to recall.
Oh, yeah.
The studies indicate that most people get their news from, say, television reports now versus the paper.
Yep.
Television.
Back here? Yeah.
Another aspect of the same problem. I teach high school journalism, and I do meet with my media sort of my kids all the time, and their number one source of news is rock radio station news reports. On average, less than a minute and a half, and are three-fourths non-news, according to what you just define news as, because it is industry related, it is music related, it is entertainment related, and that's their primary source of news. So I would even follow up on a comment, how much does my students can often tell me, kids who are interested in journalism can't tell me who is doing ABC Nightly News. They don't even know what time it's on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They can tell me what's on the independent news channel and what repeat from 1950s is playing. But they aren't even in the world we're talking about. It's like we may be discussing probably affects maybe 20% of adult America. The majority of folks out there don't have the problems where we're in, which is even scary.
The question I have is, how do you know what you're talking about?
Well,
what I hear is you reporting about reporters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That what's the difference between what you just said and all of the reporters were saying? Where did you get what you reported?
It's always a good question to ask anybody.
You may have to find another basis for living.
How many sources do you have for this story?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a culmination of our own experiences in one way or another. I have worked on newspapers. I've now taught journalists. I've done research on this where I'm gathering information through students that are working at 32 different newspapers.
Which could be more reported. That is to say, what you did is students reporting. And what you say you did research on it is someone reporting. Every book you read is someone reporting.
Well,
or they say they're making it up.
No, well, let me give you a couple examples. One of the people we're talking about on the news in Chicago makes an error. We think he makes an error. He gives an editorial based upon a misunderstanding. We call him up and we tell him, and he says, "You're right, and I'm not going to change it." I take that as evidence.
But
he's caught up in his bias. Well, he misread, he put a knot in a sentence where there wasn't one. We said we did this, and he said we did not do this, and he said it wasn't important enough to change. It didn't. The report he gave deserved time. The correction didn't deserve an equivalent amount of time. That is a single instance, but I think it's very powerful. We sitting in the presence of people who are being coached to tell a story on how to work with the media, watching the growing proportion of effort that goes in to becoming an immediate event, and then being present when you watch the media interpret the 1% of it that they're interested in. It's wonderful. You have these press conferences, and all of a sudden, somebody will start saying the cameras will be sitting there dormant because they can't tape it all. And all of a sudden, something sounds sexy, and all the lights go off. And they all record it, and then I take our video cameras and record it, and that's all that's on the air, that 2 minutes of a half-hour press conference. And then I ask people what they thought of the press conference, and they, what do they have to tell except what they saw? Now, I regard that as evidence of what happened in that situation. Then I talk to other people who have held press conferences, and they say, you're damn right, the same thing happened to me. So that, whatever that bias is, gets multiplied. And when it's the same kind of bias, the provocative statement that keeps being picked up, then you look for the way in which the media insinuate themselves into our understanding of how events happen. You're right, it can be no more than our reporting of the experiences we have. The reason it persuades me is because when I talk to other people who work with the media, it's experience they have.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then commonality. Reality becomes a function of agreement or almost voting. Listen, I've actually conducted a few experiments where I can put something on a chalkboard and people will see different things. Put a little sign up there and people will read it. And some people read one thing and some people read something else. Now if I put that up there and then erase it, how do you think they're going to determine what was really up there?
You mean once it's no longer, once the objective, well, so
that's dependent on you to tell the truth.
They don't even vote. They won't even believe me. They'll vote. And whoever gets the most votes, they'll say that's what was really up there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I've demonstrated it wasn't up there.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of, we can spend all day on this tomorrow if you want. There are a lot of instances.
I mean, you're in his field, though.
Are you a psychologist?
But the premise is that we're all fallible instruments, right? We're fallible listeners, we're fallible reporters. What we're trying to describe are common tendencies given that reality. What is it that these we fallible folks do? Yeah. And there's a certain way in which the news industry organizes its life that shapes that fallibility in a certain predictable direction. So if I bet we could set up a press conference and exactly predict what part of it was going to be on the news the next day, whether it was the most interesting from our point of view or not.
Well, but I think another answer to the question is that we also are selective in what we see and what we hear and what we think is important. I mean, that we were supposed to talk about objectivity and reality. Well, if this whole meeting had been about the problems journalists have covering the news, I, at least, and I'm sure the rest of us could talk about what is a reporter supposed to do when confronted with all these different things and 12 different people running up to him or her wanting their story in the paper, and you can just imagine doing it from the other side.
And a deadline.
And a
certain
number of inches.
And
question back here.
So far, we've been very good at faults of the media. If we as Americans by birth, we can find faults of the media. We're all very good. Any part of Americans can. What are some solutions? Besides competition, which has been an American solution, we always have alternative sources.
And we have about 3 minutes. So. Solution time.
Well, I personally think that that things are changing so rapidly now with all these buyouts and mergers and everything that it's really hard to keep track of a lot of it. But I do think that the more and more the newspapers are going to have to become much more thorough, much deeper, more like magazines than they are at the present, and people are going to have to be trained more in depth and they're going to have to be much more specialist than they are now. There's because television is going to continue. I mean, newspaper reporters are bad enough in the sense of having to be generalists, having to know a little bit about a lot of things. But television reporters are, it goes much worse. I mean, they don't even have, even in Chicago, the television reporters don't have beats the way newspaper reporters do. And they have crews, and you work with a crew of people and you could be sent any old place, and they have even less expertise. But I think that there's, a partial, a little tiny thing. I think it's that the public is going to have to become more demanding in terms of what we all are willing to accept from the media. They keep saying that, well, and then there are also some really innovative editors. This guy, Jim Squires in Chicago, actually just started a new beat called a social policy beat. And it's, I mean, their social policy beat is in Washington, and the guy is instructed not to turn in numbers stories. That is, he's not supposed to just go to the institutions and find out the latest number of people on welfare and so forth. There's going to have to be more interpretative kind of work, and it's going to have to come in the newspapers.
Just at one other angle on that, my own angle on it is I don't expect much from the mass media. I think that mass media and disinformation glutted kind of society is always going to be a very problematic instrument of democracy, and that's what I'm interested in being. And I really think that the emphasis has to be in the training, in the hard training of consumers, information consumers, which we are in much of our lives, and unfortunately we are more, maybe unfortunately, we are more and more of that in our lives. And partly that means sensitizing people to the kinds of institutional biases that mass media operate under. And the other thing it does, it seems to me, is to kick people to think about alternative sources of information. You can do two things. Read it critically and get alternative sources.
Dorothy Soleil says that we need to learn to hunger for truth, and hunger to the extent that we don't just watch TV, but we read and we read and we read with a very critical eye or critical mind.